Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture with members of the But Why Though writing staff. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kate.
Hi, it's been a while.
It has, and it's just Kate this week. We're kind of piloting a new thing. We'll talk about it. We're discussing 2010's Myth of the American Sleepover, but we're also pairing that with a conversation about kind of the evolution of how American media fictionalizes and romanticizes adolescence in America, which that's... I've had such a hard time trying to condense that to like a sentence.
We were sold lies.
But yeah, just like how did the media lie to us about what growing up would be like? But before we get into that, we want to talk about the news. There's a lot going on. We're just going to zero in on two things this time, as always. First, Toho has put out the poster and trailer for the new My Hero Academia movie. I have seen the poster. I have not seen the trailer. Kate, do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, so I believe it was the trailer or the teaser or something. It was shown in a giant room at AX. There is a member in the Discord community who watches these things like a hawk and noticed that there was no Crunchyroll distribution logo. The reason that this is interesting is because for a lot of the large films, there are two companies that release for them. That is, mm-hmm. Well, I guess technically three now. It's Netflix, G-Kids, and Crunchyroll. We're talking The Suzumes, the Shonen movies, like there was Haikyuu and now Blue Lock. And then Crunchyroll has done all of My Hero movies. And the reason that even though I love Crunchyroll, I am very happy that they are not distributing this, or at least as of this recording, it looks like they are not, is because it looks like Toho is starting to do their own distribution. The reason this is really important is because right now when you look at the anime distribution space, it is in a stranglehold by Crunchyroll. They have the majority of the rights, they have the majority of the simulcasts, the dubs, all of that. So it is a lot of the companies fighting with each other. And the reason that this is bad is because if it is one company that controls everything, they then control pricing, they then can gatekeep, they then can do a lot of stuff that only favors them and not the consumer. So... this is like pure speculation. I don't know if it's necessarily news, but I think if My Hero, which right now is kind of the standard bearer for shonen anime, in the United States, if this movie releases with no distributor that is not like the production company, it's going to set a precedent for other films to try this distribution method out themselves, which I think is ultimately better. And we'll see how it goes.
When you were saying like there's only kind of three places to go for, you know, for distribution and all that, I was thinking like, yeah, if someone said where can I watch anime, I'd be like, just anime? I really don't know what to tell you other than Crunchyroll.
Yep.
Like just as a casual consumer, like I that's the what I would point you to.
Yeah, and everybody forgets about High Dive, which is owned by AMC apparently.
Oh, really? Interesting. Okay. I knew about High Dive. Did not realize that was their parentage, so to speak. But yeah, I think this is honestly really exciting. I also saw that Toho is bringing Godzilla Minus One to 4K Blu-ray in America.
I'm so excited. Because we're getting color and minus color. I'm very excited.
It made me laugh so hard when I saw that it's being called Godzilla Minus Color.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Never change, Toho.
Yeah. It's so good, and it's such a good movie. So seeing that, and like, so seeing like, oh, you're bringing like a film that had, you know, not a huge release in the States here in 4K in like a $65 premium package, is like, they're betting on themselves a lot, and I'm all for that.
Yeah, because I think like also when you look at a lot of like the distributions from Japanese films and stuff, those are also run through a very select number of companies, especially for physical releases. And I think that it's really astounding to see these companies kind of pushing forward on their own. I really do love the current distribution channels. I actually think the companies have been kind in that they have a lot of access for press, and they are probably the least gatekeepy of all the people that I deal with. However, diversify, and that will help the consumer more. So I'm down with that.
It really will. I'm still waiting on the last season of Haikyuu to get its dub release.
It's never going to happen. I've accepted it.
It's not. I already watched it subbed because I was like, it's not coming. But I just, come on. You did everything else. You did the movie. So that was really exciting news about Toho. I'm excited to see what they do. I admittedly also have not watched the My Hero movies because I've only read the manga because I'm that
There's only good one. There's only one good one, and I hot take, do not like the anime. I stopped liking the anime at mid-season 5, so.
Okay, what story arc is that at?
That is right before Villains.
Oh, okay.
Or like
gotcha.
It's Villains-ish. They changed some things up that I just don't like. So.
Okay, are you reading it then to finish it out?
Yeah.
Yeah, which also, yeah, guys, this, like, as like, of when this episode goes up, we're, like, 3 weeks away or 4 weeks
so
away.
So that's the thing. I am essentially, I think I am 100 chapters behind, but that's because I was betting that Horikoshi wasn't lying, that he is actually going to finish My Hero. So now that I know that that's happening, I'm waiting until that last piece, and then we're going into binge reading territory again.
That, honestly, that makes sense. I have one coworker who also reads it, and like every Monday morning, he just messages me and is like, "Did you read it? Like, are you caught up?" And then we just talk about it, and it's fun because I haven't had that kind of like water cooler type show or anything for a while. But also, yeah. It's so frustrating when there's a chapter that like not a ton happens. But also, back on the topic, I was gonna ask: Are the movies canon at all?
No.
Okay.
Are shonen movies ever canon?
I mean, that's a fair point.
that's it's happening more so that they are, but no, they're not. Which sucks, okay. Because if you do choose to watch one, I would watch Two Heroes. That is the one that is probably the most emotional and gives Bakugo girlies a lot to lean on because it actually unpacks Deku and Bakugo's story. I'm gonna make sure it's Two Heroes. Heroes Rising. That's the name of it. I get Heroes confused because Heroes Rising is about two heroes fighting nine.
Yeah.
And so my brain always defaults to that. Get better at naming things, please.
I love when things just have terrible naming conventions. Kelsey and I just watched through all of the new Planet of the Apes movies.
Yeah.
And just what a disaster those names were.
It's so bad. I don't think I've ever said the most recent one's name correctly.
Is it Kingdom? Of the Planet of
Isn't
the Apes.
Isn't it Rise of the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
It can't be. I don't know. It's just, it's bad names,
it's
but
lot.
I love it for being so bad.
Yeah.
But also, that franchise has always had terrible names in terms of knowing what order
anything
goes in.
No, okay, that's what it is. I keep thinking it's Rise of the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, but it is just Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Perfect. Yeah, it's... Because is it Rise and then Dawn or Dawn and then... I don't know. We're off topic.
It's Rise, Dawn, and War.
Okay.
Yes. That I do know because Caesar Trilogy is OP, but we can continue now.
Yes. So the second thing of news, there was a... Well, okay, so first, you guys are probably familiar with. There is this story that when the Wii U bombed, that Iwata cut his salary rather than fire anybody, kind of taking personal accountability for the failure. I've seen this story repeated on Twitter, on like all social media,
every single layoff,
everywhere. And turns out, based on this report, it's not exactly true. And by not exactly, I mean it's just not. Kate, do you want to explain?
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and it was published in The Verge. It was by Lewis Gordon. And essentially, I have been screaming at the top of my lungs that people are dumb by thinking that Iwata-san was some altruistic C-suite person. He was not. Now, I will preface this by saying he could have chosen to do other things to cut costs instead of cutting his salary. So that was a move he made. However, the reason that there are not layoffs in Japan and that people in positions of power like that have to make a choice like giving up their salary is because you cannot lay people off. Full stop, yeah. You cannot lay people off. Especially
it's a pretty different picture.
Unless your business has tanked so spectacularly that you are about to close, you cannot lay people off while making profit. And that is one of the things that is really important to kind of couch this in, is because as we've seen the gaming industry go through like the gigantic wave of layoffs, and that is going to just keep happening because America sucks, everybody has talked about the need for unions. We love unions here at But Why, though. We consistently talk about unions, I feel like, every episode, and how capitalism is the devil. However, unions without federal legislation do nothing. They just allow you to get laid off and get a severance. And that is mm-hmm. something that is really important. And so what Gordon did with this piece is it's a very in-depth look at Japanese companies, Japanese work culture, and Japanese worker legislation and the protections that are afforded to employees of companies so long as they are full-time salaried. This doesn't account for contract workers in Japan. Contract workers in Japan can be laid off. However, those in a quote-unquote career cannot. What does happen, however, and which is the reason why the Iwata story kind of feels a little bit more disingenuous and how it's been lionized, is that mm-hmm. in the same breath with which a CEO like Iwata can give up their salary to maintain their Japanese employees, they can fire and lay off the people in their other companies, other headquarters in other
abroad.
Countries. Yes. So for international institutions, before you touch anything in Japan, you have to start liquidation processes of your international assets. And that is where it comes down to. Because Nintendo laid off 320 employees in Europe just a few months after Iwata and other executives took that pay cut in 2014. So they're not...
Honestly, I've never heard that part of the story.
Exactly. And that's the important thing, too, because more recently, Square Enix laid off a giant number of workers from their U.S. and European offices. However, because of Japanese labor laws, their Japanese employees did not feel that. And so, like, this is one of those things where it is like, if we lionize CEOs and shareholders and just executives in general, we do not need kind CEOs. We need better mm-hmm. laws. Because you don't get rich if you're kind. And on top of that, like... it is one choice away from you not having enough money to pay your rent. I just thought this was really important because this is something I have been saying constantly. And then, like, Nintendo people on Twitter get mad at me because they have two brain cells. One's Mario and one's Luigi. And ultimately, it was just good to feel validated and to see someone do the work to pull together all of the... information on it, all of the laws and all of the ways that international companies work in Japan, how Japanese international companies work, and ultimately what it's like to build up a company there, because they also talk with independent developers as well. So
Well, and I think just compiling it all, giving people no excuse to not know, because realistically, like you were saying, like, this is We need laws over kind-hearted CEOs, because we've seen time and time again that industries will not regulate themselves. People will not make the right choice. Mm-hmm. And so if our options are legislation that protects people or just hope that the CEO is going to have a Mr. Rogers moment, like, you're better off legislating, unfortunately. Like, I get that it's cynical, but realistically, I think it's more realistic than it is cynical, is what I'll say. To say that we need to put those guardrails in place rather than hope people know not to go off a cliff.
Exactly.
I think that kind of covers it for news. That was all very good.
And avoided the gaming industry's persistent layoffs. It's on the verge. Go read it.
Go check it out.
You
go
will learn it. A lot. And stop saying Iwata is an altruist. Just stop. You look dumb.
You got to prop up Nintendo. Got to make Nintendo look good. I think that does it for the news. So we can move on to the main segment. This is a kind of a two-parter. Again, we're playing with a format of kind of pairing a review with a topic. So first, we're going to talk about the feature-length debut from director and writer David Robert Mitchell, who you probably know from It Follows. That's his baby that you're familiar with. This was out in 2010, released by IFC Midnight. It is about the myth of the American sleepover. Like, as it's a very on-the-nose name. It follows a handful of kids on the last weekend of summer vacation trying to make the most out of it. Just with that, how did you feel overall? Like, what was your general impression of this?
I didn't get much from it because I think, and we'll talk about this when we get into, like, the larger myths about the American sleepover, is that it's very culturally defined. So I have learned, and I think that this movie, because I kind of went into it knowing what we were, like, watching it for and how we were going to talk about it. Like, I wanted to make sure that I was kind of questioning, like, my own ideas of adolescence and that stage. And I think for me, like, I think the movie does a lot by doing a little And I think that that is mm-hmm. good. But it is also just like, it's white. It's quite white.
It's incredibly white. And I think that was one of the things that I kind of struggled with as I was putting together the show notes, is I was like, most of what we're taught in media is about white adolescence. Yes. And I think there was some interesting things in this too, where, and this is something he makes a very specific world.
Yes.
This tonally felt like, this fits with It Follows more than I thought it would, as far as like the vibe, like the it cinematography, does. The way people talk, like this is, it is his movie unmistakably. But I think that something that was interesting was that it also exists. I mean, it's incredibly white. It almost felt like it existed outside of like any sort of idea of socioeconomic class.
Yes, it did as well. Yeah. Which It Follows also kind of does when you kind of pull back. Like, like that movie, there are two things that I think that this does that It Follows also does, is it exists out of any sort of idea of class structure. It also exists mm-hmm. out of any sort of time period almost. It feels very timeless. Yeah. And I think that that's something that it makes a film good, because then you're not, mm-hmm. it's not me watching Mission Impossible 1. It's like, Joe, Tom, what you doing with that phone?
No, that's something that, honestly, not to talk too much about It Follows, but something I appreciate is, like, the car's inconsistent, the technology inconsistent, the way people dress inconsistent, and it kind of just makes it easier to watch, because you're not hung up on, like, well, would that have been right? Is this right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're just watching, the myth or the parable or whatever.
Exactly.
Like, you're watching the story he's trying to tell you, and he's trying to tell it for a reason. And I think this did the same thing. So we have one of the stories, or one of the myths I think it addresses, is like my girlfriend goes to another school, you wouldn't know her. Cause there's this kid who just, I mean, the way that people use it. Yes. But like, it's like, that was absolutely in there. There's the guy who's too old to be hanging out with high schoolers. Like, who's like very interested in tracking down these two twins that he went to high school with before he graduated, because he realizes that he had feelings for them. So there's like the whole unrequited love thing. There's the house party where literally everyone is invited, where like it exists outside of like high school cultural cliques. Like, it's just like literally anyone and everyone is there. What else was kind of brought up in this? Cause he really, I feel like, goes scattershot with like,
he does,
I'm going to hit tropes.
Yeah. It's kind of like a shotgun approach to like other sleepover movies that you would have, I don't want to say sleepover movies, but kind of like those adolescence cusps of adulthood movies. It's weird. I was like, I feel like if you held this up to Can't Hardly Wait, this kind of shows you all the ways in which every single person in I Can't Hardly Wait is both a whole adult and also really bad and wrong.
Yeah. And I do want to say, to this movie's credit, the casting felt pretty...
It did. It
appropriate.
Yes,
like
it did.
A lot closer.
100%. No, it did.
I have not watched Can't Hardly Wait in a while, and now I'm like scared to, because I feel like I'm just going to be like, these are all 30-year-olds. It's going to be the 90210 thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think honestly, overall, like it, I'm not going to say I like love this movie. It very clearly is like baby figuring out how to walk. Like having seen his future works, like, cause he also plays with some similar concepts and settings and, this movie exists so that It Follows can exist.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I thought about the entire time. And then I'll say to just like, I'm realizing that it is very hard for me to watch coming of age movies. And I say specifically coming of age movies dealing with adolescence, because the other thing that's happening now is we have coming of age movies for adults, which is another interesting topic. Mm. But for the adolescent stage, because I'm just realizing how much I just don't understand. Like, I now that I'm working more at like empathizing with characters in films instead of just like watching, critiquing, and digest, I'm trying to actually get in their heads, and I'm realizing that like the cultural inconsistencies between me and them are just like so vast that I kind of check out.
Yeah, because it just becomes completely unrelatable at that point.
Because I don't feel like there's necessarily anything super universal. I do think that My Girlfriend Goes to a Different School one is probably the one thing that like I really liked, because I we still make that joke with a friend who has a boyfriend that we have not met in person yet. So, and we're like in our 30s approaching 40, and that is that is still a joke we make. So I think that is apt.
You wouldn't know her. She's not from around here.
Exactly. She's from Canada. But yeah, I still think it's good. I think baby learning to walk is a great way to describe it. If you've seen It Follows. I also I don't know. I didn't dislike it. I think it was one of those where I was like, this is a technically sound and good movie that does what it wants to do. I am not the target audience. It felt like that, that Rotoscope, Apollo 1.5, the Linkletter movie set in Houston.
Yeah.
Respect the movie.
Not the audience.
I'm not the audience for it.
Definitely. I think another thing with this one too, that I kind of realized this was my second time watching it, and to keep going back to his other work, I feel like it is almost a sister piece to It Follows, where they both follow completely different sides of loss of innocence and growing up. Like they both handle it completely differently, but in ways that are, for depending on your context and your life and everything, valid. Like they're, you know, potentially realistic, not entirely, because again, this does kind of fall into the myth of it. Like I think now that I'm thinking about it, were there, other than like the sleeping teacher at the college, like slumber party lock-in thing, were there adults in this movie?
I don't think so.
It like that was something where I was like, this feels very mythical about adolescence, is the amount of time that you exist with zero adults anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was overall, like you said, like it's a good movie. It's just still figuring out what it's doing. And if you're not the target audience, like you might not be inclined to revisit it.
Yes.
It's also, I will say, it is very much a, it leans more into slice of life than a traditional plot.
It does.
Because it is just slingshotting between these like four different stories or whatever. And you're just kind of like checking in on people, seeing how it's going.
It's very banal. Like it, like that's what it is. It takes the banality of life and is like, okay, cool. What if we look at it?
Yeah. And again, I appreciated it, but not for everyone probably. But going off of that to the main discussion, how does pop culture romanticize adolescence in America? And the first question I had when I was doing this is like, how far back do we go? Like, how far back in pop culture do you go to get to this?
I think the best way for us to talk about this is the first thing that you watched and you were like, oh, I don't do that. Like, that is a piece that I would think of, because I have a memory specifically watching Full House.
Okay.
And it was a sleepover at the Tanner's house, and then it turned into a sleepover at somebody else's house, and I wasn't allowed to go to sleepovers. Okay. If my mom did not know the parents. Like, yes. And it was made up for me. And like, I think like a lot of Latino and Black families, from like what I can tell from my friend group, like we all had those experiences that in order to go to somebody's house to sleep over, like I slept over at my cousins' houses. I didn't sleep over at like friends' houses. And if I did sleep over at friends' houses, they were friends that like my mom would invite their parents to barbecues and stuff like that. Like my mom had to know them. And a lot of that was because my mom was just very like, well, I don't know them. I don't know that father. I don't know what can happen. And then what got funnier is because that one thing, like just the idea of a sleepover. And I like even think about the one from Greece as well. Like I always wanted a sleepover like that. Going outside of that, and you get into like older, like young adult media, teen media, maybe like older teen media. You have the whole like, I'm going to lie and tell my parent that I'm going to your house for a sleepover. We're going to sneak out and do something.
You're going to tell your parents that you're going to my
house
for a sleepover.
Exactly. Yeah. One, my mom would have beat my ass if I had done that.
Oh,
two, my mom, anytime I did actually get a chance to, even my cousin's houses, my mom would call in and check. Like, and it is wild to me. And I understand that like family dynamics, parents, that is different. But like in all of the media that I have ever seen, that is a constant. Like parents just literally don't know where their kids are.
It's such a casual thing.
Or don't care.
And at most, the parents are like, I'm disappointed that you did this. Where, like, and I'm thinking, like, when I was a teenager, and maybe I just, like, I admittedly was not, like, a huge troublemaker, but I think the closest I got to that was, like, we went exactly where we said we were going and then decided, let's run out and get coffee and come back.
Yeah.
And that was, like, the most, like, going somewhere that my parents didn't know I was going there that I was willing to risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that other kids weren't doing it, but it's like, yeah, this isn't, like, a universal youth experience. And honestly, I think that when you were saying, you know, what's the first thing you remember watching that you were like, that's not real? I think for me, it's just the general concept of, like, shenanigans.
Yeah!
Like, my friends and I, like, yeah, we would goof off, we would do stuff, but, like, just like the straight up shenanigans, like the, you know, let's make a swimsuit calendar episode of Saved by the Bell, which was also like, hey, super not cool. Like, it's that they literally take pictures of the girls' swim team without their consent and then sell it in a calendar.
Yeah. The most real thing to me, which is weird too, right? Because, like, I feel like there are, like, two sides to this. So, like, looking back on this now, and I remember looking at it then, it was like, where are your parents? Like, does your mom mm-hmm. not love you because she doesn't call to find out where you are at 11 o'clock at night? Like, that's one piece. And then I think that a lot of the media went, like, the entirely opposite way, where it was like, we are going to take the most extravagantly bad situation and put you into it, because you can't simply be poor. You have to be poor from an abusive household escaping drunkards. Yep. And that makes me think of Boy Meets World, because what was crazy yep. to me was I always identified more with Sean because he was going through stuff. He was the poor kid. And those were things that I was dealing with. But then you learn more about his family and it's like, oh yeah, no, if you are poor in these things, your parents hate you. Your parents hate each other. If you have two of them, they're addicts in some place. And it kind of, like, when we look at, like, the way that it mythologized, like, the good stuff, the shenanigans, the friend stuff, it also kind of, like, mythologized the idea that, like, if you were a poor kid, it was because your parents completely messed up and were terrible people. Like, there were just not, like, the kid who couldn't afford new school, like, new shoes for like, the next school year.
Yeah.
It was either Corey with a lot of money or Sean who was escaping an abusive family and nothing in between.
The class depiction is really simplified and made strange, honestly, because I feel like most people I knew fell into that middle category that just never got depicted. And I couldn't even tell you why. I mean, and also I'm glad that we're getting into this, because one of the questions that I was stuck on was, like, do family sitcoms have a place in this conversation? And very clearly they do.
Yeah.
Even though, because a lot of them also are teen centric.
Yes.
I also now I'm having the thought of, like, do you think the rate of very special episodes changes based on the racial makeup of the cast?
Yes. Yeah. No. Because
the first couple shows I thought of were, like, Boy Meets World, Step by Step, Family Matters. And, like, Family Matters eventually devolves into, like, science fiction shenanigans every episode. But there's also some, like, special episodes early on, whereas I feel like Boy Meets World took a lot more time to build up to, like, significant ones. Or, I mean, the issue all of these shows face is that all of your problems are solved in a half hour.
Yes.
Like, how Corey finds out that people are still racist and then reads an X-Men comic and that fixes it.
Yeah. And I think that that's, like, it's, like, one of those things where you have sitcom forgiveness, but it's, like, at least you tried. I think the one series that if I think of, that, like, obviously, like, there were myths about it, but I think the one series where I looked at it and I could be, like, this is how people I know interact, this is how, like, I think my parents mostly interact, I actually think Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was one of the ones that was really on the nose with what it was like to be an outsider, to be moving through class. And I still think it does deal with some of those things that, like, if you're poor, it's utterly your fault because you made bad decisions. But I think it deals with that. It deals with those extremes in silos, because ultimately, like, what it's showing you is the middle ground of what you are as, like, the product of that versus that in and of itself, in a way that I don't think the Boy Meets World ever really did, until maybe Angela comes on in the college years. And so I think for me, like, that was Fresh Prince was the one. And I do think that these family sitcoms, that is probably where I got the most of my myths, because they were the things that were on every day and they were the things that were like readily accessible.
Yeah. I mean, and they just, there's a whole and I know that, you know, TV is not real. It's not supposed to be, but there is this whole version of even what family life is like that is just not really accurate in any of them. Just the, you know, the relationships that, the way that relationships form and strengthen and weaken and, you know, introducing like a new, like growing pains, adding, you know, a baby after several seasons and then just trying to roll with it. And, you know, and that's another show that also, man, I didn't even think about that when I was putting this together.
I watched a lot of Growing Pains. Everybody on that cast is batshit crazy now, but like, except for Leo, Leo's fine.
Yeah. And Ashley Johnson, is she normal?
I don't know.
She does a Critical Role, right?
I don't watch that.
I'm pretty sure she's
This is the year that I embrace that I don't D&D and I don't care about your D&D character. That's what I'm embracing this year.
I do D&D, I don't Critical Role.
I lied for so long pretending to be interested in D&D. I'm pulling that cord now.
It's gonna I think there
my
are
truth.
I'm going to say there are probably better tabletop RPGs to get into. Not that I don't enjoy it, but I'm like, there's better options for people. Not everybody's going to like this. Anyway. Yeah, so there's just like this weird depiction. I think the 80s and 90s really is where all of this like mythologizing is in like full force, like really intense.
Yes.
And it, you know, it's everything from like, I would say even like something as simple as like food availability.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like that's this weird thing of just like, oh, there's always snacks and you and your friends just eat whatever you want. And I'm like, growing up as like a middle class, lower middle class kid, that was not like, you know, like my parents were never going to be like, hey, stop eating. But like this, like free, what, like all that kind of stuff is like, and maybe that's also more from like commercials is where I saw that too. Yeah. Like that, like if we're going to bring that in as pop culture.
Yeah.
I will say though, I think that more recently we've been getting shows that kind of handle it better. Like On My Block, I think was a much better coming of age show.
It is. I will say too, like I think On My Block, because I think On My Block for me, and it does devolve into hijinks and shenanigans. But there is something, I think Hentified also does this, but I think On My Block, because it's more of that very specific time in life of like teenagers, that was a series where it was one of the first ones where like I could see the stereotypes that me and my friends made for each other and our other friends. Was it a firework? Was it a gunshot? That is something that we played consistently growing up. One of my very good friends in middle school got shot by a cop. And that is something like she wasn't shot by a cop in the show. I mean, she was killed off because she pretended to be Latina, but that girl ended up dying in a drive-by. And as much as like, I didn't have that, I had lost friends to gunshots. We did have a rule to live below the window when you slept, so you wouldn't have that happen. And it's one of those where like all of this sounds like really grim and dark, but like the thing is like there is joy made in these communities even with these circumstances around them, and when how you navigate that is something that I think is interesting, and I think that On My Block does it really well. And I also think, to the point of like them just going off and parents not caring, these parents cared and talked to each other, and they were never fooled when somebody was gone. Abuela knows where everybody is. She's just choosing not to step in. And I think that like those are those little things where you can just change something small.
I think also something that On My Block did well, and I mean, a lot of shows tap into this, but an aspect that feels mythic, but the more I think about it, I'm like, no, that's real, is what I would call the singular focus, which in On My Block, it's Roller World. It's like, this is the one thing that all of us care about. We're all sunk, like, you know, we are all in on. And that to me, I was like, oh, this actually is like very relatable. Like I remember my best friend and I getting guitars and we're like, cool, we're doing the band thing. We're writing music. We're like, all we're doing is like playing songs, writing songs. Like this is our singular focus. Like, and, or like, you know, the summer that we all got longboards and decided that that was all we were doing for the summer.
Yeah.
But then I feel like you get to other shows and the singular, like older, sitcoms and coming of age shows, the singular focus doesn't last.
Yeah.
it's, and you know, I mean, that's just kind of an, I feel like we're also hitting on just things that were bad writing. Like how many times, going back to the example of like, oh, that person's poor and from a horrible home and yada, yada, yada. Do you remember the homeless Christmas episode of Saved by the Bell?
I do.
Okay. And you remember how the end of that episode, that girl and her dad are moving in with Zach's family and then we never see them again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just one that bugs
me. Between that and Slater coming out as Chicano, those are like those.
I forgot about that.
And then the it's not Jesse, it's the showgirls one with the caffeine.
No, that's
pills.
Jesse Spano.
Is that Jesse? Okay, yeah. The caffeine pills.
Yeah, she gets hooked on caffeine pills, and that's their very special episode. I mean, I think the myth there too is that like your problems are only so much. And like, I don't know if it's that the studio wouldn't let them depict her like doing anything harder than that. Like if maybe the original script is like Jesse's doing coke. But like, then you go to, you know, I mean like think about like what counted as a very special episode on like Family Matters, where I think, you know, they do like much harder hitting stuff and dealing with it, you know, much harsher realities. I thought I had an episode in my head and then I realize that I didn't.
Well, I think a lot about like the drunk driving episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or the dad episode where like he comes back and he's just like, my dad didn't want me. And I think because those are probably the two episodes that I think the most about that have like because I think that there are very few moments that a very special episode actually spoke to me as a kid or like because like I think about that drunk driving episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air probably more than I should. Like I like that it hit in a different way. And I think also like the Dad Doesn't Love Me episode, like I know a lot of people like that clip gets shared a lot, but like I have issue. I don't have a biological dad in my life. I have a great father. Yeah. Like he's my dad, but like those same things. And I think what Fresh Prince did, and I think that when like connecting to what you said about writing is I think that there is a large span of like 80s and 90s television where they were writing what they thought people that age did. And they were writing what they were told people that age did, but they weren't necessarily writing from experience or thoughts on what they had done. And I think you kind of see this shift in the late 90s into the early 2000s where you do kind of see that. I don't want to say start to change, but like more hands kind of get put into the making of these things. I think Degrassi is probably another one where I was like, they definitely had their very special episodes, but like it was really good. Like I was really tuned in on Degrassi and those characters were believable and the class dynamics were actually probably some of the best. Like it was just like, oh yeah, no, that dude's just poor and has a single mom. Like nothing beyond that.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that like that was always interesting.
Yeah.
But that was also not American.
I was going to say Freaks and Geeks is the other one that I
look at. Oh, yes. Freaks and Geeks.
Which, although that
good.
One was interesting because that one's a period piece. Like that one came out in the 90s, set in the 80s, very much of the 80s. Like there's a whole episode about getting an Atari for Christmas. But that one was like, okay, we're going to, I think one of the things they hit on was like one of Sam finding out that his friend's dad is cheating on his friend's mom. I think that is the Atari episode.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's like a heavy thing to hit on, but like that's a little bit more real. And then, you know, just like the general dynamics of the friend group and that it's like, hey, not everybody is a popular kid. So we're going to focus on Freaks and Geeks. Like that's what we want to look at because that's what we haven't been giving airtime to. Mm-hmm. There's so much around. I think popularity is like its own conversation that the show is almost always about the popular kids.
It is.
I mean, even when it's quote not about the popular kids, like
it is. Still,
like Boy Meets World, case in point, like where it's like, oh, they're not cool. It's like, but everybody's obsessed with Sean.
Yes,
and everybody likes Corey.
It's one of those things too. Is like I think like looking at a lot of it as well. Is because those are touchstones, and then I have like the early aughts and like 2010s that I watched a lot of, like the OC, and One Tree Hill specifically were two shows where like, and the OC always knew what it was. It was poor kid goes to Orange County to live with rich family. Rich family has drug problems and random stuff. Like, it was a melodrama. It was never grounded in the world. And then you have something like Wintry Hill, which I think is a very interesting look at success in that space of coming of age. Because what happened in that show is you start with a pretty grounded story and these kids coming of age, and you have a poor kid who's poor, but like his mom loves him, and like, yeah, they don't got a lot of money, but he's not doing drugs. He's not like, he's just a poor kid who's good at basketball.
Yeah.
And he was the bastard son of like, I forget what he was, but like a top dude in the town. And his main confrontation is with his half brother, who is like also very good at basketball, but rich. And like a lot of those interpersonal connection, interpersonal relationships that get built there, they're more recognizable as real. I would even argue that their like school shooting episode that like every one of these stories had was more real, which I want to come back to that in a second. But then what happens is as the seasons go on and as they get older, as they pass the adolescent stage and as they've kind of come of age and they're graduating, like it's a sharp decline. Like that senior year of high school, absolute crazy, like crazy pants. There's a heart transplant and a heart falls on the floor and a dog licks it. Like it goes off the rails, kind of like how this rambling is going for me.
That the dog and the heart thing, that just completely sucked. I forgot about that.
But like that's what I feel like there were more grounded things that were happening where people were trying to actually speak to cultural moments and differences, but ultimately as things went on and as shows got bigger, they ultimately collapsed under their own weight. I would argue even On My Block deals with that in its last season.
Yeah. On My Block's last season, it was interesting what they were trying to pull together, but also it was like this, it was, so there's a very good moment in the sitcom Community where Abed says to somebody, I miss when this was just a show about a community college. And there were multiple times, like that line, that sentence structure is something that my partner and I reference constantly, like when we're watching something that just so severely got away from what it was about. And there were a couple moments in season 4 of On My Block where I was like, remember when this was just about like four kids trying to find buried treasure? Like when that was the whole premise. And I also want to go back though and say, I do think hearing you kind of like recap the OC's premise, I think what's interesting there is that as much mythologizing as that show did, it also very interestingly confronted the idea that money solves anything.
Yes, it did.
Like by structuring it as like, what if you were on the wrong side of the tracks and you cross them and it still sucked?
Yes.
And it's like, oh yeah, like that's a good call out.
The
like,
OC
that's a legit...
was a good show. Like I will die on that hill.
Yeah. It's just really interesting that like for all these other things that it like propped up as far as like mythologizing, that one, it was like, no, that's nonsense. Money doesn't fix anything.
No, rich people suck and they all have drug problems or they just
suck differently.
They spend their money on drugs and getting drunk or they buy comic books. There's no in between.
Nothing else. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm also not to like ping pong all over the place, but going back to the idea of like Freaks and Geeks as a period piece, just looking at how depictions have changed over time. Like if you go back to the 80s, you have like John Hughes movies, I think are like, that's where so much comes from.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like, again, like every trope about like, you know, being popular or like prom being the most important night ever. And all, you know, like there's, I mean, do we even get into like sex comedies, like 90s era teen sex comedy?
So I thought about this. I thought about this long and hard. No pun intended, but like, I think sex is one of those things that was highly mythologized in a way that it was never as cool or grand as any of it made it seem to be. The people I know who lost their virginity on prom night, of which I actually didn't know many, it sucked.
Yeah.
It sucked. They hated it. It was probably in a car. Like, not a good experience. And then
you mean having sex in a car in a floor length dress is not a good experience?
Who would have known? But everybody, like, I do know that I had a lot of friends who tried to do that because they thought that that's what happened because of movies. And like, what's crazy is like actual like teens having sex at my high school. Like, it was just like somebody went out to, like, not even like under the bleachers, but like a building that was across the street that like nobody parked in, and like and like, or it was like in a car. Like, there was also like
my high school had like one staircase with a blind spot.
Yeah,
and that's what people used.
Yeah, and like, and it's crazy because like, it's not that like kids weren't like aren't horny, like, because like obviously hormones.
Yeah,
and stuff.
that part's not a myth.
Yeah, that part is very true. But none of it was extravagant.
No,
none of it was extravagant. Not at all. It was all uncomfortable and weird. And I think that it's crazy because like I think that like of all of the things that have kept across each of these, and to go back to what I think On My Block does well, is it doesn't mythologize that part.
No.
It sucks. It's awful. And most of the times you'll break up with the person right after. And I think that like that is one of the things that I do think has stayed. Like, I think that like writers now are attempting to tap into their personal experiences, so they're kind of doing some more grounded things. But I think the idea of like the 90s sex comedy turned into the 2000s sex comedy, turned into the 2010s sex comedy, and like Blockers was is still technically a recent movie. Like, people are still mining that, and they haven't disproved it. Riverdale, I'm looking at you.
Man, Riverdale is guilty of so much of it. Riverdale is also guilty of the, we're going to cast people outside of an age group and then weirdly sexualize them because they're legally adults and we can, even though they're depicting minors, and it gets into a lot of weird stuff. But that also goes into the myth of what your body's going to look like as a teenager.
Yeah.
I just remember somebody one point tweeted a season one picture of Tom Welling in Smallville, and they were like, they really told us that this was like a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And I think he was like in his early 20s by that time. Like, and like, yeah, I get that he's Superman, but like, come on. Like, there's, you know, I think that that's why it's so interesting now when we like watch something like Myth of the American Sleepover or On My Block, where it's like, oh, the fact that you got within like 5 years on your cast, that you're within 5 years of your character is impressive now.
Yeah.
And actually, I think a lot of On My Block was more than 5 years, or closer than 5 years, I mean. Other than Jasmine, is that her name?
I think Jasmine was the only one who is older.
Yeah, I think she's closer to our age, yeah, if I remember right.
And it's crazy too, because I would say, and I want to know what you think, like, do you think like shows are getting better? Because like when I tried to think about like coming of age TV shows, I don't think we're getting as many of them. But the ones that I do know that I did really like was, I loved Heartstopper. And I think that is a very good, like, they're teenagers. They look like what they're doing, like, who they're playing. They're having, like, complex ideas of sexuality and sex and intimacy and identity and friendship. Like, the fact that they don't lose friendship as a core value in all of that is really interesting. Mm-hmm. On My Block, of course. I think Never Have I Ever. I've only seen the first season of that, but that's
another grounded story. Oh, I love Never Have I Ever. Story. Start to finish. Great show.
Very good to know. And I need to
even that
it.
One, it does do like some mythologizing in the way that like all media does, but it still comes back to real problems and real reactions to those problems.
And I think that that's like the question. It is like, it is any sort of media, in order to strike a chord, has to type into a myth. And I don't need people to think about like, oh, myth, the Roman gods. No. Everything we do that perpetuates an idea of a important time in life or an important space, that is creating a myth of that thing. And I think that media, when it is done and when it is shown, it is tapping into a myth. It's what they do with the myth. Do they dispel it? Do they prop it up? Do they use it as a launching point? That I think you end up in a very different situation based on kind of how you go and where you choose to kind of put your focus.
No, I think that's a really good point, that it... Because I should say that I'm not against the mythology aspect of this. Like, we fictionalize things in fiction because that's the definition. But I think that you're right, that it's, well, what are you doing once you do that?
Exactly.
Like, you've caught it. What are you, like, what's step two?
Yes.
And I think that that's kind of what was so interesting with Myth of the American Sleepover, was that it starts off with a firm grasp on all of the myths that it wants to talk about, and then it it explores them, and it some of them it does more with it than others. But ultimately, like it is there to explore, not to prop up or dispel necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, it's a movie that knows what it wants to do and it does it. I think the question of whether or not shows are getting better, I think it's kind of a mixed bag, only because while we do have things like On My Block and Heartstopper, I think we also have Euphoria. Which I don't even know how to get into that in relation to this, because that's not...
Euphoria is bad skins. That's what Euphoria is.
And it's... I wouldn't even say that it's, like, propping, like, mythologizing anything in a good way, but it's just, like, it's a kind of a hot mess of a show, to my understanding.
It is.
And so, yeah, it's just kind of hard to be like, you know, because I hadn't thought about Heartstopper as a coming of age, but that one is really good. And it also tackles things that have not traditionally been tackled mm-hmm. by media about teens. Like it very much, I mean, the main story is about a gay kid and his spoilers for Heartstopper and the guy he has a crush on who turns out to be bisexual. And then there's their greater group of friends where one of them has recently transitioned and another one of them has a crush on them. And, it just does a lot to explore those things in a thoughtful way. And in, you know, a happy way, cause you know, the whole like not kill your darlings, but just like literally like kill your gaze. Like there's gotta be a tragedy. Yeah. Bury your gaze. That's the phrase. And so for this show to be like, no, we're not going to do any of that. We're just going to explore it is like, yeah, I think that actually is a marked improvement on mythologizing. Cause also I will say that like a lot of the turns in that show do end out pretty well for characters. Yeah. And they're getting into harder ones, but what's wrong with a happy myth every now and then? You know?
And I think that that's like, I think that that is where I think media has started to go past. Cause I think there is a larger embracing of like people talking about what they went through. And I think one of the mm-hmm. important things that I've seen happening more, and I want to happen more in that young adult, like coming of age media, whether it's television shows or TV, is like not everything is a life ending problem. And the fact that you mm-hmm. are in the writer's room at like in your 30s, in your 40s, and can look back and write about a bad thing that means you survived it and you made it through, maybe show your mm-hmm. characters also doing that. Because I think that is one of the things that like you had like one of two things kind of like with you were rich or you had an abusive father and were extremely poor. It was either like you had something excessively bad happen to you and you shot up a school or like everything was peaches and roses or something bad happens on like an episode and your life is going to decay and crumble and you will not survive. And I think that those extremes is something that mythology buys into and needs to buy into to continue. But I also think if you embrace that mythology, but you explore it in a way that feels more real, you're going to end up in a better spot and you're going to become something that is like long lasting for having a good impact versus long lasting because you devolved into some chaotic stuff. Like, let me tell you about the highs and lows of high school football. You don't want to be remembered for that and the werewolves and whatever the hell time travel there was and the throuple that was kind of married. I don't know. Riverdale is a trip, but
it really is.
I think that there is space to do more. And I think more people are.
Yeah. And I think the key is, and this is something that I'm just piecing together as you were talking, is the reason that like fictionalized mythologized shows kind of don't hit right in historically like older ones is that they have given those characters a sort of invincibility. The consequence doesn't in the same way that your problems are solved in 20 minutes, your consequences are gone by the next episode.
Yes. I think like the reason that's important too is because it wasn't just let's talk about grief for teenagers for an episode. It was let's talk about this like the sustained trauma that one event can cause in your life and the ways in which it will keep popping up, but you just have to get past it. And that is what that show does instead, which I thought was really, really good. Like Rudy's
also that it also kind of goes to why you can have or why arcs are maybe the better media. Like, yeah, you can't watch it out of order, but now that we're not doing, you know, syndication necessarily for every single show, people aren't going to be watching it out of order. Yeah. I'm not going to hit shuffle on My Block. I'm going to start season one, episode one, and I'm going to go through it. Mm-hmm. And I think because we've changed how we tell stories through streaming, we can kind of change the kind of stories that we're telling. Like, yes, there is still space for those episodic, every week is a new shenanigans, like Ed, Edd and Eddy style TV shows. Yeah. But like, not every show has to be then. We can do more interesting things. Or, I mean, you could even go, granted, this is more an Americanized K-drama. You can go the route of XOXO Kitty, where like, yeah, it is kind of new shenanigans every week, but there is also a story.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that like, and we can wrap our conversation, kind of kick this to your next thing, but like,
yeah,
sitcoms died. And I don't know if that was a good or bad thing.
Yeah, it like there are still comedy shows, but they're it's different, and I can't even put it into words.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, where do you stand overall? Like, do you, and obviously, like, we are in our 30s now, so like, I don't know, yeah, what myths are being perpetuated, and I am now looking back and looking at something in a way that I have a lot of distance from, and I think allows me to have that space to think about it, or even look at the myth of the Great American Sleepover and be like, oh yeah, well, that actually, like, that wasn't me. But if I had watched that movie 10 years ago, would that have been me? Like, when this came out, if I had watched this 14 years ago, would I have, mm-hmm, would I have been more moved by it? You know what I mean? And I think that, like, that is something that is interesting when we talk about this, is talking about coming of age movies, talking about coming of age media, and looking at like the way that we've mythologized adolescence and childhood, and like what it means to cross that liminal threshold into, mm-hmm, adulthood, that also shifts as our own positions change. Because I think that, like, yeah, everybody, regardless of what you've been through in life, I think that everybody has those moments in their life where they can remember where they grew up. And, mm-hmm, you can remember where, like, those, like, touchstones, not to, like, use a Spider-Verse thing, but you can remember those canon, yeah, events that started to shape you from child to adult. And I think that the farther we get away from them, the more that we do tend to mythologize them ourselves, but we do also start to say, oh, that wasn't me. And so I think that that is something that's also interesting to think about.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about that with this idea of why, I mean, these shows are being written by adults. And so it's kind of like, well, why, where is this mythologizing coming from? Like, what are they pulling from that? And, you know, again, there's always interference in the creative process. There's studios saying you can't write something that's that much of a bummer, whatever. But at the same time, like, these are still stories that adults are choosing to write this way.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to examine, like, is it that that's how you remember it, or that's how you want to remember it? Or, you know, like, what's the benefit to writing that story? What's motivating you to write that story? And I think that that's something that's kind of, I can't answer those questions for writers. Like, I, you know, we would need to bring someone on the show to be like, explain yourself. But yeah, it's just, again, I just keep coming back to, like, it's the myths aren't bad, but you were spot on. Like, it's what you do with it. And I think shows are maybe catching on and starting to do more interesting things with it. And also revisiting, you know, older tropes and older media, and kind of trying to put a new spin on it, trying to, you know, approach it with fresh eyes,
yeah,
and see what the actual truth was versus what we were initially presented.
Yeah. To be honest, I kind of feel like the most, I'm not using backwards as like a bad thing, but like the most, like, the past, like, coming of age, like, show I've seen was actually Jenny, mm-hmm, and Georgia on Netflix. It's not good.
Oh, I haven't watched that one yet.
It's melodramatic as hell. I would recommend watching it. It reminds me of those shows.
Okay.
It's really interesting.
I'm in this headspace now of, I'm remembering all the shows we didn't.
There's so many. Dawson's Creek. I never watched Dawson's Creek. I watched like a couple of it, but I wasn't allowed to because my mom found out there was a sex scene in it, like in okay, an episode early on, and she was like, "You can't."
I feel like
this.
I saw a couple episodes when my sister watched it, and it was like, "Oh, I'm gonna watch this while she's watching it because this is the, yeah, cool teenager show."
Yeah.
I remember none of it.
I would argue Buffy. I think Buffy, oh, yeah, was a formative coming-of-age TV show for me. Also, like, the first time you have sex, your boyfriend loses his soul. Like, how messed up is that? Like...
Yeah.
Anyway.
And that's, like, something for people to work through in terms of, like, how America talks about sex.
Yes.
But, yeah, man, yeah, this was a really good conversation. I have not given this much thought to, like, teen media as an adult, as a man in his 30s in a while. But now I'm like, oh, maybe I do want to go revisit some of these old things. Honestly, now I'm like, remake some of those old things and like tell it better. Like, you know,
this
like,
is they're trying to do that with Bel Air. I haven't watched it, but I think that's what they're doing with Bel Air, like the the remake of Fresh Prince.
I was thinking like remake Ferris Bueller's Day Off. If you want like a character who has nothing but shenanigans and invincibility, like it's that movie.
That's fair.
But like, you know, doing a coming of age thing about these people who are like afraid to graduate and to move on to the next step and they don't know what it looks like. And so they're just trying to like lean into their youth and into like embracing life as much as possible. There's a good story there. I do love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I don't think that movie really has a lot of lessons for people.
Yeah.
Also, I guess I should say with the catch that not everything has to have a lesson. Sometimes things are just fun.
Yes.
And that needs to be okay. But yeah, I think that that kind of does it for me. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, that's it. I think that, yeah, we're in an interesting spot. All I'm doing is leaving this conversation with more questions about
same
things.
Yeah, no, hard agree on that. Do you have any articles that you want to plug or any media that you want to recommend?
So I think
related or otherwise
right now, the new anime season just started. So there are a whole bunch of anime reviews up for the summer season up on boatwaitho.net. We have coverage coming out of Anime Expo. So if you've ever thought about like, ooh, what does the director of Apothecary Diaries think? Or what do the voice actors of my favorite anime like think? We have those. We have interviews with a lot of the folks from the fall season. Oh no, is it fall season? Summer season? Spring season. That's what it is.
Oh.
Anime seasons are weird. They're always off.
Yeah, I wouldn't have got to spring.
Yeah. And then I think for me very specifically, I'm reviewing House of the Dragon episodically. It started rough. It's real good now. It's real good now.
I'm excited. I'm two episodes behind. I need to catch up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, I just played through Animal Well. Have you heard of that one?
Yes, I have. I've heard so many good things.
I should say I played through to the first time that credits roll, but apparently there's a whole like second credit roll if you keep going, and I think it goes like three layers deep of like there's more and more to do, just if you want it, if you want to explore puzzles. So Animal Well is a single developer game published by Big Mode, which is the publishing company started by Video Game Donkey from YouTube. And so it was like, yeah, this YouTuber started a publishing company, picked his first title that he was going to publish, and kind of knocked it out of the park. Like, the developer made an incredible game. He picked very well for his debut game for his company. It's basically a Metroidvania with more puzzles and zero combat,
That's cool.
is the way I can describe it. And it is increasingly cryptic the further you play it. The power-ups that you get are just, like, completely... Like, one of them is it's a slinky, is the power-up that you get. And so when you see, like, a platform where there's, like, steps down, you can drop the slinky and then see, you know, like, there's maybe, like, a switch at the bottom. And you're like, okay, well, what does that switch control? And, like, what's the timing to drop the slinky and get to that and do this? Yeah, it's just a very fun game. Genuinely very... very well put together and very impressive for being a single person. I have heard that eventually you're just going to have to look up a guide, that like there's a point where just one person's brain is not going to figure it out. But yeah, highly recommend it. It's really good. But yeah, I think that kind of covers it for us here this week. You can find But Why Though basically everywhere. Is there anywhere that we're not? I always rattle off a million things.
No, we're everywhere. We are everywhere.
Yeah, so come find us. We're also on Patreon. That's an important place to find us. If you like this show, if you like the site, if you want to keep it all going, kicking us a couple bucks a month on Patreon, it goes a long way to do that. As for me, I'm on Twitter at mostalwaysalex. Kate, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at omymythrandir. Yeah, I'm back into Final Fantasy. I've been back into Final Fantasy for a while, but yeah, no, like 9 hours a day, staying up till 2 a.m.
I've seen that on Discord where like I open it and it's like Kate is on Final Fantasy
consistently. Nice. I live there. I live in Thrall now.
Excellent.
Yeah,
love that for you. Also, yeah, Elden Ring DLC. If you somehow are playing Elden Ring but have not grabbed the DLC, go grab it. I'm only a few bosses deep, but it's fantastic. I was up until I think like almost. Was it almost midnight last night just playing, which was maybe a mistake because I had to work early the next day. But yeah, Elden Ring DLC is great. Final Fantasy is great. Animal Well is great. Anime is great. Go check out stuff. find us online, talk to us. We would love to hear your thoughts on this week's topic. Kate, thank you so much for joining me. And those of you at home, thank you so much for listening.